Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. In today's episode, I had with me Zoltan Vardi. Zoltan is a startup mentor and angel investor who helps B2B tech founders struggling with sales to build predictable, recurring revenues using his sales and marketing blueprint called the Launch Code. In today's episode, we talked about closing a $500 million deal, cracking the corporate fortress, searching out deers instead of elephants, moving from local to global, and schooling me on my value prop for Emerge One. This is a great episode for anyone who wants to understand how to build out their sales process. You're not going to want to miss it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today with me, I have Zoltan Vardi via Zoom. Zoltan is a startup mentor and angel investor who helps B2B tech founders struggling with sales to build predictable, recurring revenues using his sales and marketing blueprint called the Launch Code. Zoltan, really great to have you with me here today. And obviously for our listeners, they can catch up on a bit of your background and some of the tools that you're using on the primer episode, but really great to have you here to have a bit of a discussion about how to build those sales funnels.
Absolutely, Arish. I'm looking forward to a great conversation.
Awesome. So let's get straight to it. You have closed $2 billion worth of deals over the course of your career, right? You must have some scars equally. I'm sure you have some amazing war stories. What are the best and worst deal kind of processes or deals that you've experienced over the course of that career? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd say, you know, if you go with the assumption that the biggest is the best, which is not necessarily true, but I'd say certainly up there. I closed a $500 million deal back in the late 2000s when I was vice president of sales for SBS Broadcasting, which is a group of 24 TV channels across 9 markets in Europe, covering Northern and Central and Eastern Europe. And there I negotiated this deal with one of the largest media buying agencies called Group M. And it was a huge process to coordinate the interests and align the interests of 9 different markets, pulling those all together and getting the deal over the line with a very significant player in the media space. So I'm very proud of that, just in terms of the actual size and the scale of it.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, that it's not my best deal, because I think the best deal is also a function of where you feel like you took something from concept to execution in a way that made a meaningful difference to you as a company, or potentially you as an individual. And I have to go back almost 20 years to when I started my first company. We launched a portal network. They were still portals at the time, in the early 2000s, covering Central and Eastern Europe. We called it kind of the Yahoo of Central and Eastern Europe. And so it was a business called eEurope Media. And, you know, we were a kind of early stage company, and we were developing this business, and we desperately needed a few big name customers to prove our position in the marketplace. And so we approached Hewlett Packard and learned that they were investing heavily into digital photography, which is its very early stages at that time. And so we sat down with the managing director that ran that part of the world, and we created a completely integrated solution, created a separate section on our portal where our visitors could upload their photos. Basically revolutionary stuff for the time. Obviously it's difficult in the context of today, where everybody's got an entire, you know, photo studio in their pocket, but it was really unique. And I remember we were at the final stages of our negotiation, going back and forth, and we sat down in a conference room to sort of have our final discussion. And I have to say, we really needed this deal, right? I mean, this is one of these things that would be something that would be a great feather in our cap. And, you know, big logos, you tend to draw other big logos. And they were getting into the stage where they were really asking for a bunch of extra stuff that just didn't make sense. It was one of those things where they're trying to, you know, screw that final screw in a little bit too tight. So it was this moment I remember thinking to myself, it's like, look, I can do one of two things. I can give everything they want and walk out of here feeling like I got screwed, or I can stand up and regain my composure. And I actually stood up and I walked over to the other side of the table and looked the managing director in the eye, who was probably 20 years my senior. And I said, look, you can either haggle for an extra 1%, or we can close this deal now and create a meaningful partnership. And he kind of looked up a little bit shocked, and he just stood up and he shook my hand. He said, let's do it. And I remember walking out of the room my heart rate was probably at like 200.
Sweating bullets. Yeah, I can imagine.
and the great part of the story is we ended up selling this company 18 months later on the back of partly this deal because of a relationship we created there and also because of the brand name that we got. And so I think the lesson for me here is that the best deals are the ones where you feel like you really got the right value for what you're selling and that you were able to present a compelling argument for why what you're offering is a meaningful solution to a meaningful problem. And I think that's a great lesson for me that I've taken with me in the subsequent 20 years.
Truly kind of win-win, right? Like where everyone comes out of the room feeling they got exactly what they wanted. You know, they're not sort of being pressured on price. They feel like it's a fair deal. And yeah, I mean, I typically, you know, I personally don't like doing deals where it feels like any one of the parties within that deal structure is losing out on something, because it just will lead to antagonistic behavior down the track and all sorts of other stuff. And what are some of the scars that you might have carried with you over the last 20 years or so?
Well, I would say that it's difficult for me to find a single moment or a single deal that I would consider sort of like a bad deal or a scarred moment. But I do want to reflect on exactly what you just said, which is that I think the deals that are the worst deals are the ones where you usually do them just for the money. And what I mean by that is, of course, sales at the end of the day is judged on its ability to generate revenues, right? That's the KPI. Having said that, so many times in my own career and even with the customers that I work with, I find that they do deals because they really need the money and they end up regretting it.
Yeah.
Right. So what usually happens, you reflected on this a moment ago, where, you know, there's antagonism and there's maybe a bad personal relationship. Maybe you've got a bee in your bonnet and vice versa. And so there's, you know, a little bit of bad blood there. But what's most important is that if you end up doing a deal when they're unfavorable terms, or with something where you really have to do a lot of bespoke product development, the execution becomes a nightmare, right? And it just turns into a much bigger problem. And what it does is it not only jeopardizes the quality of the deal you just did, but it jeopardizes your ability to close other deals, because you end up sucking out a bunch of time and resource to satisfy this one deal that you didn't really want to do instead of focusing on new business. And so I think for me, the big lesson here is if there's a deal there that just doesn't feel right, I know the money is important, but you will literally regret it 99% of the time. So stand up, walk away, and look for better customers who are more appropriate for whatever you're selling.
Yeah, I think walking away is an underrated talent, right? Say it's that art of getting to no, maybe, rather than the art of getting to yes. And yeah, I mean, I can, you know, I can think back over the last 15, 20 years, you know, very similarly, where I've kicked myself for taking on a deal because it felt good, you know, in terms of getting the cash in, but I knew it was going to be a nightmare dealing with a client. And unfortunately, more often than not, I've been proven right. So let's get on to kind of some of your thoughts on how to actually kind of build out that sales process and so on. So look, dealing with enterprise customers is hard enough, right? We all know kind of the lead times that it can take, the amount of pressure they put on. But for startups who have limited track records and ultimately limited resources as well, it's even harder. So you talk about cracking the corporate fortress, right? What are the key activities that startups and founders should use to breach those corporate defenses, if I can put it that way? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it starts, first of all, with understanding. And what I mean by that is that when you're a startup, your mindset is very much about speed, right? Mm-hmm. It's about moving things forward quickly. It's about testing, breaking things, getting to yes quickly. When you're speaking to corporations, you are talking to people who have the polar opposite approach to business. The single most overwhelming principle of corporate decision-making is certainty, right? That is what is driving everything. What does that mean in practice? Scenario planning, you know, projects are budgeted. Decision-making is slow. It's built on consensus. People, you know, focus on internal politics. You know, their belief is that speed kills, right? And I say this because I've run 1,000-person organizations. I've worked in that matrix sort of organization where everybody's responsible for everything, but nobody makes a decision on anything. So I can speak from personal experience that that there is just generally a sense that you know, making a decision too quickly is the bad thing. So the reason I emphasize this is because it's important that this clash of mindsets is understood and accepted, because it's sort of like gravity, right? You can be really angry that, you know, the pen drops out of your hand, but that's just the way that life works, right? So that's, you just live with it. So that's the first thing. The second thing, and that's to manage expectations. The second thing is, I think you have to make sure that when you think about enterprise sales, you don't lump every company into the same basket. Not all corporations are created equal. There are certain characteristics of companies who are more likely to do business with early stage startups than others. Mm-hmm. What are some of those characteristics? First of all, I would look for what I would call companies that are deer rather than elephants. So elephants, of course, are the big lumbering animals, the market leaders, the ones who really don't have that much incentive to change because they're already in a strong position. The deer are the ones who are second tier, maybe even third tier within their category, who are much more limber, much more agile, are capable and are willing to try new things because they have something to win, right? So they have something to gain. So what I'd say is look for deer rather than elephants. Focus on private companies rather than publicly traded companies. Why is that important? Because publicly traded companies work to quarterly results. Mm. They're not prepared to take significant risk that is going to damage their public stock price. Look for companies that have a strong HQ or central decision-making authority, and make sure you speak to those and don't waste your time talking to subsidiaries who don't have the budget or the authority to say yes. And look for startup-friendly signs. You know, there's a lot of companies that have corporate accelerators. They have corporate venture capital arms. They have maybe a head of innovation or, you know, relevant leadership role. These are all really important signs that company is better for you than others. So if I had to kind of like create the perfect corporate customer, challenger position, privately held, headquarter decision maker, and startup friendly element. Those are what I would think to keep in mind as you target these type of customers.
Yeah. And I think what's also super interesting to me is often, you know, when you're working with larger corporates, the champion, right? The person who is actually going to use your product isn't necessarily going to be the person making that buying decision. So how does one navigate like figuring out at what stage they should move up that chain of decision-making? Because do you need that champion in place first? Presumably you do. But then how do you get from the champion to the budget holder and the decision-maker thereafter?
Yeah, I think you make a great point. Finding that internal champion is a really critical hack or element that you have to keep in mind as you go through this process. I think that you have to spend a bit of time identifying and building relationships with people who will help you manage you through the system. You know, they're like the shepherd, right? They're guiding you through that system. They help out map out the decision-making process. You know, the ideal champion is somebody who is a subject matter expert. So they understand the kind of the area that you're coming from. They have the authority and the position of respect in the organization, and they sort of take part in senior level meetings. They're not necessarily the MD or the top person, but they're sort of one level below. And so I think if you focus on identifying those relationships, you will be able to get to yes more quickly. The challenge here is finding that person, obviously, and then building that relationship. And so this comes back to a little bit of what I said earlier, is that, you know, the process itself is not perfect, right? It's not like you can map it out and step by step, but you can do a couple of things to improve your chances. The first thing you can do is solve a problem that matters. And I often find this with early stage companies, is they're selling a tool that, frankly, in the grand scheme of things, isn't going to really have that much of an impact on the business.
The painkiller versus vitamin kind of story.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think that if you think about the corporation as a decision-making authority, you know, center, if they're going to go through the process of the pain that I just described, it's got to be something that's going to make an impact on their bottom line. And, you know, one of the areas I work with a company in the automotive space out of Poland. I supported them, and they were selling to big factories that produce auto parts. And they offered this tool that had basically enabled companies, these automotive manufacturers, to audit their factory processes more effectively. And as when we first started talking about this with them, you know, they were really narrowing their focus on a very, very tiny piece of that process. And I said, look, for these companies to take you seriously, you got to offer something that's meaningful. right? And then we started adding certain elements, and it actually turned out that he had all these elements. He just wasn't packaging it correctly.
Right.
And so I think that's what it comes down to, is you have to make sure that you're solving a problem that matters. And the other thing, you have to build credibility, right? So sitting in a corporate environment, you know, there's an old saying from the 1950s in the United States, nobody ever got fired for buying by IBM, right? And I think that's part of the challenge as a startup, is you're not IBM, right? Mm. You don't have that logo that people remember. So basically, you have to build credibility in other ways. That goes with how you pitch and package your presentation. That matters. You know, it's got to be professional. That includes introducing elements that show your past experience with corporations. If you happen to have worked for a company that has a brand name, make sure that people know that, because again, it adds credibility. Prove that you're here to stay. Prove that you're not a fly-by-night company. Going back to automotive, you know, most of the technology that they incorporate into automotive companies or cars is actually about 7 years from deployment, right? It takes about 7 years for an automobile to be actually deployed to the market. So imagine, they don't want to do business with a company they don't think it's going to be around, yeah, because it's one thing to deploy it. The other thing is after sale service and all that stuff, right? So those are all the different things that are going to help you build credibility. And that's why it's also important that you look for ways to work through partners who already have a relationship. So channel sales is a really important part of the corporate sales process. Looking for companies that already sell some sort of relevant product or service to your target customer, leveraging their authority, their access, their presence, and using that to get in front of potential corporate customers is a great way to build credibility and to build your chance of success.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously sit on the finance side in a lot of these businesses. And one of the questions we often get asked by larger corporates or incumbents, or certainly even, you know, we haven't talked about state-owned customers, right? Quasi-statals or anything like that. But, you know, one of the questions that's frequently asked is, you know, send us your balance sheet, your P&L, et cetera, because they want to have the comfort that you've got the cash and the cash flow and the stability to continue delivering the product or the service over the long term, which, you know, is going to be challenging for a startup. Yes, they may have investment. Yes, they may have an okay balance sheet today. But, you know, if it looks like there is a lack of strength in that balance sheet on the horizon, then, you know, it's going to be that much harder to sell in.
But I think if you're talking to a company that's asking for your balance sheet, you're probably talking to the wrong company.
Yeah, I've got to say, like, often those are red flags on our side. Like, you know, you will essentially just say, well, that client's going to be too hard to service.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I think it goes back to what we talked about before about saying no, right? Yeah. Sometimes the success comes not from who you focus on who says yes, but who you don't speak to. Mm. You know, that's what's going to help you focus your efforts on the customers who are most likely to be interested in what you're saying. And that's actually one of the critical parts of the launch code, is that you have to create a structured process to reach the customers who are most likely to say yes. And that comes with identifying an extremely clear ideal client profile, not just doing things like, well, you know, the number of employees and the revenues, but like, you know, what's their mentality? What have they demonstrated in terms of what's important to them? Are they more focused on quality or quantity? You know, do they have some, you know, association with sustainability or with some element of modern culture that makes you a more compelling customer for them or partner for them? So there's a lot of things you have to do there that then is brought to life through the process of outbound sales and inbound marketing and partnerships.
Yeah, no, look, it makes a lot of sense. So, you know, another big challenge is geographical expansion, especially for European companies trying to move into the US, breaking ground out there, where, you know, we know that it's easier or more likely that you're going to be able to acquire quality logos, and there's certainly more volume of those quality logos. So how should they think about moving from local to global?
Well, I'd split this into kind of planning and then execution. On the planning side, I think it's really important that you find your focus. And this is something I talk a lot about to B2B tech founders, is you can't be everything to everybody, because then you're nothing to nobody. Mm. You need to be able to focus your efforts. And that goes to the point about, you know, what is it that you're actually focusing? So you're focusing your positioning, right? So, you know, you do your market research, look at competitive offerings in particular markets you're interested in entering. Is there some gap there that needs to be filled? Is there an underserved niche? Is there a geographic blind spot? Is there a pricing position that you could fill, right? So think about your product, not just, I've got something to sell. It's like, okay, how can I position this in a way that's going to be compelling for this new audience? And that does, by the way, require sometimes you to revisit your value proposition, maybe your product offering, maybe even adjust your product somewhat to fit the market. Once you've done that, then it's important to focus your market entry. And I like to support a kind of a three-pronged approach. If you think about, you know, a military operation, it's like, you know, by land, air, and sea, you know, it's outbound sales, it's partnerships, it's inbound marketing. You have to try to use all three of these tools to create a presence in that new market, to get your first couple of quick wins, to get your first customers on board, and then to build the business in the long term. That's kind of the planning element there. The execution piece is much more practical. My recommendation is pick three markets. Mm-hmm. So if you're, let's say, in the UK and you want to expand into continental Europe, then use various parameters. It could be some research. It could be the competitive landscape. It could be some accessibility question of how strong your ability to actually enter the market is. Pick three markets. If you pick three markets, that helps you, first of all, focus this concept of internationalism into something that's more manageable, right? Because three is kind of a manageable number.
Yeah.
And it also gives you the opportunity to simultaneously start building insights and relationships in three markets, see where you get the best traction, and then start focusing your efforts on the markets where you're getting the most traction. And in my experience, because I've done this literally dozens of times, generally out of the three, one starts pulling ahead pretty quickly, one starts falling away pretty quickly, and then one is kind of there in the middle. So it just sort of tends to work that way. And then you put your efforts into the ones that's really working well, and then you know, put all your resources into making sure you do it well in that one market, and then repeat.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a couple of things actually to dig into there. So we had a few weeks ago, Annalisa Dragish on, you know, she's a Series B to IPO investor. And, you know, we talked mm-hmm. about the difference between kind of earlier stage where it's all about product market fit. But at later stage, it's go to market fit, right? It's having that replicable playbook to be able to go out and execute yeah. in different territories. But again, you know, to your point, I guess often there is this, you know, approach by some founders where, okay, we're just going to launch everywhere and therefore yeah. don't launch anywhere. And one of the questions I guess I also have is, you know, how important is it to have boots on the ground in those locations as you are starting to enter? Like, market penetration is, you know, tough at the best of times. Is it made easier by having people on the ground, or is it better to have that centralized until you figure out that playbook and then start deploying kind of sales agents out there down the track?
I would very much support doing distance selling until you've got your first few paying customers. Mm-hmm. The reality is that as you're developing your business, there's a constant shifting in messaging and ideal customer profile and offering. You know, this concept of like, I'm going to kind of create this one time, it's going to be perfect, is just fantasy land. It's like this constant iteration. And you have to go through the pain of the iteration before you can then say to yourself, all right, I'm going to put a lot of resources into local market to bring that to life. And let me give you a very specific example. So one of the companies I'm actually chairman of, a company called Antavo, I'm also an early stage investor in the company. It's basically an enterprise loyalty management platform. It works with large brands, global brands, to create loyalty programs. Very experiential type of loyalty programs. And so, you know, been with the company now in certain capacities for almost 10 years, and it's built itself into a global company, you know, with customers in all across Asia, Europe, and North America. And interestingly, although the company is based in Europe and actually in the UK, it has about 7 or 8 paying customers in the US, but none of them were acquired by local presence. They're all acquired through some combination of outbound sales and inbound marketing and partnerships. And so right now, with about 7 or 8 customers, we're able to close, you know, meaningful business. But we're just at the stage now where we're going to be putting some more investment. And that's would be a big mistake to do that before you've got your first few customers, because you don't actually understand the problems you're solving. And let's be honest, it's also a function of your financial resources, right? If you got $50 million in the bank, yeah, you can put a lot of money into, let's say, entering the US market. But just know that that money is going to burn through very quickly. And you, quite frankly, you might end up, you know, putting a lot of expensive effort before you've actually identified whether you've, you know, what your offer is exactly that's going to yield meaningful results.
Yeah. So there's, there's a couple of questions that comes out of that. First question is, you know, at early stages, especially, you know, it's very important for the founder to be selling, right? As companies kind of move up, you know, move up in terms of the volume of customers, et cetera, how important is it, and especially breaking into new markets, how important is it for the founder to continue to be the main salesperson for the business? Or is it okay for them to, you know, palm that off to, you know, head of commercial or CRO or whoever it might be?
Yeah, I would say that there's kind of a three-level process. If you're starting out, and you want to establish some sort of local presence, which I, by the way, believe that it has to happen at some stage, right? I don't think you can build a global company with just, you know, one central location.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, one of the nice things about this hybrid world in which we live in is that there's a whole range of people who are doing part-time roles and in part-time consulting roles with various companies. There's a lot of people who you can kind of negotiate with or contract with that'll represent you on a part-time basis. So it's a relatively light touch.
Yeah.
That's, I think, a good way to start. That person can either then turn into the second level, which is a full-time employee or employees, or you can find then somebody who's willing to commit 100% to your company. And so you can hire somebody full-time. And then I think there's the founder on the ground, right? Which is when you're actually, you got somebody there that's going to be representing the company. And let's be honest, the founder always is going to have much more credibility than an employee. It's just a natural reaction. So I'd say I would go through those first steps. So having that part-time kind of consultant, external person, then go into full-time employee, then founder on the ground. The only alternative is if the founder is, for personal reasons or cultural reasons, whatever, more than happy to move into that market first, you know, at a first go, that's fine. But not everybody can make that commitment. You know, I mean, that's a huge commitment. Depends, you know, just change in lifestyle. If you have family, I mean, there's a lot of things that you have to consider there. So I think that kind of three-step process is probably the smart way to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, again, as you said, essential, like, you know, founder is always going to be able to sell, hopefully, their product better than an employee. They just have much more invested in making sure that sale happens. But equally, they can get overly fragmented if they're trying to do that in multiple markets. And the other thing I wanted to kind of pick up on, you know, you talked about, you know, if you've got 50 million in the bank, yes, you could throw money at it, but you'll burn through that very quickly. And actually, you and I talked when we first caught up, you know, about that sort of issue that, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of capital out there and often, you know, the growth at all costs kind of mentality has led to money just literally being thrown at marketing, especially, but sales as well. Yeah. And just assuming that, okay, if I hire an extra 5 business development people, that'll lead to 10 more leads, which will lead to X amount of new business. But actually the reality is that, you know, often that isn't the case. So now, as capital has become tighter, what can people think about in terms of what they have been doing in the past and what they should be doing now in terms of really efficiently using that capital?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you make a very good point that the world has changed. You know, I saw a statistic recently, ironically, I think it was Silicon Valley Bank that put out the research, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was recent. I think that the numbers I remember seeing, or just at least percentage wise, is that the total amount of invested capital in Q4 2021 versus the total amount of capital invested in Q4 2022, there was a 60%
drop. 63%, I think, was the 60, number.
So obviously you've seen the same research.
Yeah.
So obviously a tremendous amount of contraction in terms of available capital at, of course, much lower valuations as well. So that's just the reality of the situation. We know that, look, startup investing is cyclical, right? We're now in a downturn. I'm 100% certain that in 3 years, nobody will remember the downturn other than it'll be in the history books. But you know, that's kind of the situation. So yeah, you've got to react to that. So I think, you know, for instance, again, at Atavo, you know, we're very much focused on making sure that we're deploying capital in the most efficient way possible. And obviously in this case, this means some cost cutting, and, you know, a lot of companies overhired when they when they were in this big boom. So you, I mean, you read all these tech companies letting go of thousands of employees, which of course is not fun or great, but it's the reality of the business. So I think that there's a cost management element here that I think needs to be considered. The second element is it requires you to focus your efforts on the clients who are most likely to convert. And I think that's a really important principle, right? Because, you know, with money, you sort of get this additional resources, and then you sometimes start shooting and throwing darts in all sorts of different directions.
The spray and pray again and less qualifying.
Well, maybe we should do this. Yeah. And so what we've done is we've really focused in on the categories. Like retail has traditionally been a very strong part of Antalo's business. So the retail sector, fashion, you know, we're going to the customers that are most likely to be interested in what we're saying, what we have to say. And so I think that that's a really important element that comes out of this is once you have less money to spend, you have to focus more, which, by the way, is a great thing because you can have five salespeople out there in the market. But if they're saying the wrong things and they're saying it to the wrong people, it doesn't matter. You know, so that's why I emphasize so much in the launch code the importance of focusing your offer and message, right? That's pillar one. And the reason I say that is because in this extremely tech-driven, tool-driven mentality, people forget at the end of the day, people buy from people.
People,
you know,
yeah.
They're buying. Yeah, yeah. And you have to have an extremely clear value proposition. And you know, my standard sentence is, in one sentence, tell me what problem you solve for who and why you're better than the competition. And you better say it so that a 12-year-old understands.
So you know? let's just try that for a second, right? So it's taken me a while to figure out how to vocalize my value prop in uh-huh. exactly that way, right? So my value proposition today is, you know, we are a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups and scale-ups. Done.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. So say that slowly for me.
So we are a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups and scale-ups.
Okay, so what I'm missing there is what's your key benefit and what's your competitive advantage? So I understand what you're offering.
Yeah.
Why is that good for me as a target customer?
So why it's good for you is that, you know, we're able to better manage your runway, ensure that you can scale efficiently. And again, let's face it, in the current environment, you know, you need to know your numbers.
Okay, so what you're saying is if I'm a venture-backed company or, you know, what you're helping me do is manage and deploy capital more efficiently.
Correct, yeah. Okay well, that that's going to go on the back end of that sentence now, yeah.
Okay, and then what is it that you're doing differently than everybody else?
It's just the experience that all CFOs have.
Okay, do you have a special system or special approach or special insight that you use?
So this is the interesting thing, I guess, with the sort of service that we offer. All too often, many people have kind of taken a cookie cutter approach. Our approach is that there is no cookie cutter, right, when you're working with startups, because every single business that we work with is different. And I think this is why it's difficult to kind of succinctly put out that value proposition, you know, in a sense, because we're not just targeting e-com businesses or SaaS businesses. You know, we work across biotech, medical devices, AI, SaaS platforms, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so that differentiates factor is that we are flexible and, you know, we understand a variety of different
so,
models.
So I would say first a comment and then a suggestion.
Yeah, sure.
A comment is, I think one of the misconceptions about tailoring your offer is that that's helps you to provide a better solution to your customers.
Sure.
I disagree with that. If you provide a blank slate to target customers and say, hey, we can do anything, what you're actually doing is you're giving them the job of figuring out
what they need. Yeah.
What they need.
Yeah.
You're much better off identifying three very specific offers. Mm-hmm. These offers could be packaged as, you know, entry level, standard level, premium level. They could be independent from each other, or they could be built on each other. In other words, you have to do step one to do step two to step three. You can do, you know, if you get this package, you get, you know, you have additional features in second one, third one. What you're doing there is you're giving them a framework for decision making. Mm. And they're saying to them, look, here are three different options. Now, a majority of people, in fact, roughly about 80% of people, will always choose the middle option.
Yeah.
Not too hot, not too cold, just right from Goldilocks. Mm-hmm. They choose the middle option. So make that middle option your best balance of value
to price
and cost.
Yeah.
And then make the entry level someone that gives you almost as much value as the middle one for a slightly less cost, and make the premium one really all the bells and whistles, because there are some people that just want the best. And what you're doing with that is you're actually pushing people in a good way to choose the middle option. And I'm 100% certain that if you put a little bit of digging into your service, you would identify the typical problems that you're solving, and you could put those into various packages and give people a little bit more context of what they can decide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And what you're doing then is you're speeding up the decision-making process, because what you're doing is you're giving them a tool to help them make a better decision. So this is actually the second module of the Launch Code. It's product offering. It's creating three options that help people make decisions more quickly. Say yes more easily, right? Now, to your specific situation, here's what I would say. So obviously not memorizing every single word, but I would say you're a consultancy that helps venture-backed tech companies manage and deploy their finances more effectively by providing them with fractional CFOs targeted to their specific business niche.
Got it. Thank you. Well, that was a free lesson for me, and apologies to the listeners who had to suffer through.
Well, but it's a good example, right?
Exactly. And to be honest, you know, over the last several years, trying to even getting to that first value prop that I said right at the start, you know, has taken that time for me to actually narrow it down. And that's only through, and I think this is your point, right? Only once you have worked with and understood, you know, why your clients are buying for you, why your customers are buying from you, that you can actually just succinctly get that value proposition out there, right?
Yeah. And by the way, the process you go through is painful but necessary.
Yeah.
And second, it goes towards focus, right? So whatever you think you're providing at the beginning, what you ultimately will provide at the end will be some niche element of what you thought originally.
Yeah.
And that's the process. And if I think about my own journey in this current role, you know, look, I was CEO of a 1,000-person organization. You know, I consider myself a pretty good manager. At the same time, I spent 20 years in sales, right? So I've got a lot of skills that I could sell. At the beginning, I was saying, you know, I'll help you build your business. And like, okay, that's great. Well, what does that mean? Do for me?
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean? Right. And then I realized, okay, well, actually sales is what I'm really, really, really good at. And actually that's what these guys really need. You know, at the beginning I was thinking, well, I could work with small businesses. I could work with startups. What I learned is that small businesses have a very different mindset than startups. Yeah. Startups think global. They're usually service technology driven. They want to scale quickly, right? So I eliminated the small business part of it. I really focus on startups. Now I'm realizing that actually the tech startups I work for and the ones that I support best are run by founders who are product-led tech guys and not commercially focused. Why? Because they're the ones that are struggling with sales. Yeah, they're the ones that really, really need a blueprint to figure out how to make sales and marketing work, because for them it's voodoo. In fact, it's the funniest thing. I just had a mentoring session with one of my clients, and we're just finishing up our program, and I was asked for very detailed feedback. And the way he said, you know, up until I started this program, I thought sales and marketing was some sort of voodoo. And now I understand it's actually a very structured, processed approach, which I can implement, which is great because these guys, generally tech people, are very process driven, right? Yeah. So I think just through my own experience, I can tell you that you will likely do something, a much more narrow niche of what you're doing now as you progress, because you realize more and more that just because somebody can use your service and would benefit from your service doesn't mean they should use your service. You've got to be the perfect solution to one narrow niche rather than a decent solution for many people.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it comes back to trying to be all things to all people versus doing one thing really, really well. And I think a lot of founders, a lot of tech businesses that I've worked with kind of suffer from that. Oh, we're gonna launch this product, this feature, we're gonna add on this, we're gonna provide this service on top. And then actually ultimately, you know, they struggle to actually figure out not only what their product therefore is, but also who their ideal customer is, right? And they get caught in this kind of mire.
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny because one of the first customers I worked with is a company that is in the area of social media analytics. So they basically analyze literally millions and millions of social media and digital conversations, and they draw conclusions as to what people think about a certain product or a certain service. And I remember these guys had been around almost 3 years when I started working with them. And so at that stage, I was thinking, okay, well, they'll have their ducks in a row. And it was really interesting as we got more and more involved in the process, how much they hadn't clarified their value proposition, how much they hadn't clarified their product offering. And so what was going on was that it was a very frustrating environment, because for the exact reasons you just described, the product development wasn't focused because they didn't know what problem they were solving. You know, their organization was misaligned because there wasn't a clear idea of what everybody's doing, like how they're contributing. So getting this focused offer message is not just about sales. It's actually about the entire business, because what happens is once you get that right, and I, by the way, I experience this all the time. When we go through the process, we get that one sentence right and it resonates and they feel it. Literally, physically, my clients like relax. You know, their shoulders drop, they start smiling and like, ah, I finally understand what we're doing. And it's a really invigorating experience, because you really see that this is not just about, you know, offering a business solution. It's like you're making people's lives better, because they just like, they're more comfortable. It's like comfort and clarity is what they experience.
Well, I mean, and, you know, as I say on a regular basis, revenue is the best form of capital, right? Like it is, you know, and is the cheapest, right? So if you if you can get to your, get your business to a place where, to your point, you have recurring revenue and predictable revenue, then you can plan. And if you can plan, you can build your business well. And I think that, you know, certainly at startup level, you know, the earlier on in life your business is, the hardest thing to do is plan, and right, so the more certainty you can give to that process, the better. Look, Zoltan, it's been amazing talking to you so far. So just as we kind of wrap up, obviously the podcast is called Nothing Ventured. It's about, you know, taking that first step, backing yourself. 2023, as you mentioned earlier, has been challenging, to say the least, right? The back end of 2022 and coming into 2023. But for founders of B2B ventures out there who may be listening to the pod, you know, what is the most critical thing that they should be doing today to set themselves up for success when we talk about sales?
I'd say focus your efforts on the customers who are most likely to be interested in what you're offering. So don't fall into the trap of just spraying and praying and getting out there and being in front of many people because you're thinking, you know, I need more customers and I need volume. You know, really focus your limited resources on the ones that are most likely to say yes. Dig deep into those, understand your customer, understand their problems, and provide a meaningful solution to a meaningful problem. And that's going to get you through these difficult times. And parenthetically, make sure you manage your cash carefully, because at the end of the day, you're useless if you're cashless.
Yeah. And of course, that's where we come into into the picture. But, you know, and again, presumably to your point, right, if you are talking to your customer again, I mean, I've made this mistake, you know, not many times, but I have made this mistake, you know, building the product that you think your customers want rather than building a product that your customers absolutely need, right? Like, and that is one of the big problems that I think a lot of founders, you know, certainly first-time founders will always make, right? They'll go out with an idea. They have a, you know, a really strong perception and conviction around what they're building because it's a pain that they've suffered, but they haven't necessarily gone out and figured out, is anyone else really suffering from that same pain? Is it something that, you know, that they would then buy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Zoltan, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here today. I've learned a lot. I hope our listeners have too. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you online? Clearly, you're on LinkedIn. Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place for them to come looking for you?
So anybody can find me on LinkedIn, obviously just under my name. I would love to connect with business-to-business tech founders who are struggling with sales, who have that challenge, who want to build predictable recurring revenues, because that's basically what I do. And I actually want to make a special offer to your listeners. You know, I mentioned several times this value proposition, the importance of the value proposition. So I've actually created sort of a 5-step process to create that single sentence that we just tried to do kind of off the cuff.
Yeah.
And it's the lowest hanging fruit. It's where you actually experienced immediate results. And I want to share this process with your listeners. So if they just go to zoltanvardy.com/podcast, that's zoltanvardy.com, my name, /podcast. They can access this free value proposition video guide. It's a 30-minute video. and a worksheet that they can use to create their own value proposition. If it's something that they find value in and they want to have a follow-up conversation, they can reach out to me through the website and through LinkedIn, and I'd be happy to have a chat with them.
Amazing. Well, look, I'll be checking out that free tool myself and give myself a bit of homework. But look, Zoltan, okay. It's been absolutely wonderful having you here today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.